Well, good morning. I'm Jeff Elton, and it's good to be back again. I was here a couple weeks ago at Brentwood and at Franklin last week, and it's just a joy and honor to get to fill in this summer while Rob's been out on sabbatical, and give Rob and both Lloyd, even with vacation time, just some time away. So honored to get to step in and appreciate you tolerating me while I'm here with you. It's such a joy to do. I had a privilege this past week of spending a few minutes with Rob and hearing a little bit about his sabbatical, and I'm so glad that he'll be back next Sunday. You'll get to hear more. Just a sweet time of rest and God's richness in his life. And for that, I hope we can all rejoice in his return next week. Today, we return to our study of Genesis and the life of Jacob. And this may completely catch you by surprise, but we're probably going to talk about him deceiving again. Wow, go figure, right? Like every week during this series, that's what we're doing. 2 weeks ago, we looked at the ultimate deception. Not so much Jacob deceiving last time, but Laban, his uncle, deceiving him. The story of Rachel and Leah and how he worked for 7 years and Jacob thought he was going to get Rachel. But as the passage said so powerfully, the morning after the wedding, but behold, it was Leah. Laban pulls off this switcheroo and Jacob wakes up with the wrong wife. And then he gets the other one, but he has to give Laban 7 more years of work. So we pick up today with it's 14 years later and Jacob is probably ready to be done with Uncle Laban. If you have your Bibles, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 30, verses 25. We're going to go through 31:16, but we'll only read some selected verses this morning since it's such a lengthy passage. Verse 25. As soon as Rachel had borne Joseph, now this is son number 11 for Jacob. Just slow down for a second and think about this. In these years since his wedding day, there have been 11 children born, 10 boys and one girl that we know of. And so now Rachel has just born Joseph, boy number 11. Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you that I may go, for you know the service that I have given to you." Again, Jacob is ready. It's pretty straightforward. I want to go back to my home country, Canaan. Remember, back in Genesis 28, when Jacob encountered God at Bethel, God had said, "You will return home. You will be with your people. I will bless you." But Laban is reluctant to let Jacob go. Verse 27. But Laban said to Jacob, "If I found favor in your sight, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. Name your wages and I will give it." Laban wants to renegotiate a new contract. I mean, he's scheming, first of all, by the divination, probably some form of like card reading, we would think of some kind of witchcraft, something totally inappropriate. But he's going, "Hey, here's what I know. My stock is going up and there's a 1-1 correlation with you being here, Jacob. So I want to keep you. I need you to stick around a little bit longer. I don't want to let you go." So Laban tries to renegotiate. And then Jacob responds this way, verses 29 and following. So Jacob said to Laban, "You yourself know how I have served you and how your livestock has fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased abundantly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?" So Laban said, "What shall I give you, Jacob?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything if you do this for me. I will again pasture your flock and keep it. Let me pass through all of your flock today, removing from it every speckled and spotted sheep and every black lamb, and the spotted and speckled goats among the goats, and they shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come to look into my wages with you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, shall be counted stolen." So simply stated, Jacob sees an opportunity and he's going to try to work it. And so does Laban. Laban sees an opportunity, as we'll see in just a second as well. Jacob's opportunity is, "Hey, I'm ready to leave. Laban's willing to pay me more, but I don't want this contract. I don't want this deal we've had where I'm basically working for room and board, it seems like." Instead, Jacob is saying, I need to renegotiate, and I'm looking for a major profit-sharing plan. I mean, did you hear the words? That's really what he's doing. He's going, "Look, I'll work with you, but I want to leave with some of the animals for myself. I want them to be mine." In that land, goats were normally black or dark brown, seldom white or spotted or speckled or striped. And sheep were nearly always white, rarely black or spotted. So Jacob said, "Look, let me take the rare ones. Let me take the unusual ones. Let me take maybe even the defects. I don't care. I just want to leave here with something. Laban, can we work a deal? Can I do that?" Well, Laban sees the opportunity also, and his opportunity once again is to cheat and deceive, verse 35. So that day, after Laban agreed to it, after that day, Laban removed the male goats that were striped and spotted, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and put them in the charge of his sons. And Laban set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob pastured the rest of Laban's flock. Y'all, Laban can't help himself. I mean, deceivers deceive. Cheaters cheat. And Laban immediately removed all the spotted striped animals. The one that Jacob said, look, all I'm asking for is let me have the rejects. Let me have the ones that don't look right. And what does Laban do? He moves them away. I can understand his thinking. If I get them all out of here, there won't be any more of them. So Jacob's going to work for me for free, and I've got him hooked in again. Laban must have thought to himself, winner, winner, chicken dinner, or winner, winner, sheep dinner. He must have thought something like, man, I've got it all now. Nobody's going to take anything away from me. But Jacob has a plan of his own. In verses 37 and 42, I want to summarize them this way. Jacob starts his own scheming to make sure that he gets away with something that he wants. This next section that we look at, it takes 6 years. Jacob serves another 6 years, but this time he's trying to gather and develop some riches and some wealth. Jacob's plan is simply this. He uses this old superstitious tale that went something like this. Break some branches off a tree. You peel the bark back. You make them look striped. Then you take these branches and you lay them down by the watering hole where the sheep and the goats come. And it's that place where the animals are going to mate. The superstition was this, that if an animal sees something striped, something spotted in front of them, once the mating happens, the female will then give birth to an animal that looks like that stick, looks like those spots, looks like those different shapes. Y'all, obviously science blows that out of the water. Not a chance that's what was happening. But follow the story in these verses as you read them along later today, and sure enough, that's exactly what happens in the story. There's goats, there's sheep that are born, and they meet the criteria for Jacob to keep them. So his little scheming, I'll use some superstitious tales and I'll work my magic, if you please, so I can get what I want. But that's not all. He also does what I would call some selective breeding with the animals. The passage tells us that Jacob would begin to sort through. He'd keep the strong animals, the strong goats, the strong sheep for himself, but the weak ones he would send off to Laban. Again, you can hear the picture of Jacob's scheming and deception continuing to happen. Again, Jacob is going to Jacob. It's just what always happens. Verse 43, kind of the result of all this that's happened, all this scheming to get this, here's what the Bible tells us. So thus the man Jacob increased greatly and had large flocks, female servants and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Y'all, his scheme seemed to have worked. Jacob has gathered excessive wealth. I mean, so much so that he's able to negotiate with the flocks, with the animals, and be able to get camels, donkeys, male servants, female servants. Jacob has prospered, and it seems it has happened through his shrewd scheming. You know, we talk a lot about Jacob in this series, and the Bible does in this section of Genesis we're in, talk a whole lot about Jacob being this schemer and deceiver, and rightly so, he is. But Jacob is a paradox of a man. Have you caught this yet in the story? Jacob, schemer, deceiver, is also a man of faith. He's a man of fear, yet he's a really good man trying to understand what God's up to. Jacob shrinks back cowardly in one moment. In the next moment, he moves forward courageously and speaks confidently. He trusts in his own ability and his plans, thus the scheming with the sticks and the poles. But he also trusts in God's promise that was made to him back at Bethel. Now, aren't we all like Jacob? You know, I said last time, we all have a Jacob in us. Jacob is the story of all of us. I deceive, but I'm also a man who trusts. I scheme to try to figure out how to get my way, but there's moments when I just pry my hands open and I surrender. I believe. I doubt. I think this is the story of all of us. And in chapter 31, we're beginning to see Jacob make that move, make that transition to live, at least in this moment, a little bit more as a man of faith. A man who's really realizing that my provision, the prosperity I've experienced back in chapter 30, it's from the good hand of God. Over these next 11 verses, we are going to see how Jacob begins to speak of what God has done for him. Well, in verses 1 through 3, we see there's tension that is mounted between Jacob and Laban and Laban's sons. They're upset. Jacob is taking our father's wealth. He's making our fathers broke. He's taking our inheritance. And in the midst of this, for the first recorded time since 20 years earlier, God shows up and speaks to Jacob. Listen to these words in verse 3. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I shall be with you. Now again, back in chapter 30, Jacob's got this hunkering. He's got this longing. He's ready to go home. But in chapter 31, God says, it's time. It's time to go back home and I will be with you. And through these next 11 verses, we see Jacob as he begins to show to his family some of the faith that's beginning to grow in him. And Jacob pulls his wives together out in the field and he says, let me just talk to you. Let me tell you what's going on. New plan. We're about to leave here. And he reminds them, first of all, I've served your father faithfully. I've tended to his flocks. He's renegotiated my contract over and over again. I am now ready for us to move on. And here's why. Listen to these four statements that Jacob makes. They're really fast in this passage, but they're so important. Jacob speaks as a man of faith this way. In verse 5, he said, God has been with me. God has been with me. The passage says this, I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. God has been with me. Notice that little juxtaposition. Your father, not for me. The God of my father, he is with me. Secondly, Jacob says this, God has also protected me. Verse 7 of this passage in chapter 31, your father's cheated me. He's changed my wages 10 different times. But God did not permit him to harm me. God has protected me, Jacob is saying. He's making this declaration. I know that it's not by my wits and my scheming. Rather, God himself has protected me. Verses 8 through 12, God has provided for me. Kind of the third lesson Jacob has learned and he's sharing with his wives. Thus, God has taken away the livestock of your father and has given it to me. This is that moment when Jacob goes, okay, it wasn't my sticks. It wasn't my selective breeding. It wasn't my scheming. The good hand of God, God is the one who has allowed me to experience success, to experience prosperity. He has opened up the door and accomplished what he promised he would do. And finally, in verse 13, Jacob says, and God has directed me. He quotes what God has said to his wives. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. The same God, again, who had revealed himself at Bethel 20 years earlier, has spoken, and Jacob has said, I am now wanting to leave this area because God has directed me. You know, for Rachel and Leah, they've never really agreed on anything. And for Rachel and Leah, they come together, and in verse 16, they actually agree upon something. They agree with what they've heard Jacob say, and they realize it's time to do it. Verse 16, all the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do. I love that phrase. These two women, sibling rivalries, we talked about them a couple weeks ago, Rachel and Leah, they come together and they go, hey, if God's telling you to go, you're right. He has protected you, has been with you. He has provided for you. If he's saying go, then let's go. God has spoken and we need to listen. You know, at the core, this section that we're in today in Genesis 30 and 31, it's the theme that we've heard over and over again. God is faithful. God's promises will never be thwarted. God has a plan. He's working behind the scenes, ahead of the scenes to accomplish it. God does it in spite of our sin, our failings, our shortcoming. Again, he can't be thwarted. He can't be stopped. God does it by his grace so that all the glory goes to him. And it's not about Jacob. It's about what God has done. And one of the other important truths not to miss in this part is this. Deception destroys relationships. Deception destroys relationships. The deception that's happened between Jacob and Laban, it's damaged their relationship with each other almost beyond repair. Maybe there's hope coming in a week or so. But at this point, it's damaged. The daughters, these daughters, they say, look, we no longer want to be around Dad. Dad has treated us like foreigners, they say in the text. He has disregarded us. He has abused what we've been given. Boy, isn't that a great Father's Day sermon? Dad, we want nothing to do with you. Dad, we want far away from you. Yo, that's what's happening. Deception destroys relationships. It always does. You know, as of today, we're a little bit more than halfway through this summer series. It's just a 14-week series, and today is week 8 of it. And in this series, we've consistently seen deceiving and scheming, lying, struggling, broken promises, power grabs. It's all been there. Guess what? In the next 6 weeks, it'll be there again. It's going to continue to show up. That's the meaning of Jacob's name, deceiver, deception. It's so present. I've said before, the story of Jacob is the story of all of us. And I think these chapters that we're doing this summer are so instructive for us in a culture that's kind of lost its moral compass pretty much completely. Deception rules in our culture, and not outside of the walls, by the way. It rules in our culture. It's so natural. It's so easy to fall to that. And as I said, deception destroys relationships. Think of it this way. It destroys our relationship with God. When we're lying, when we're deceiving, we're scheming, we know something's not right. We feel out of sync. It destroys our relationships with ourselves, the shame, the guilt, the fear that we walk around in. When we know we're up to something that's not right, man, it happens in here. And finally, the impact of deception that it has on our relationships. As I said, deception destroys relationships. You know, in the rest of our time this morning, I kind of want to call an audible a little bit. I kind of want to push pause. And what I wish I could do is I wish I could run down to my office and grab my little, I have this little tan colored chair that I sit in every day. And I wish I could just bring it in here, sit down in it and say, hey, can we just talk for a few minutes? Just like people to people for a few minutes. We've looked at the passage. We have a good understanding of what's going on in Jacob's story. But can we just talk a little bit about this word that's so key in Jacob's story? And that's the word deception. It's kind of like in the old days, if you were around fellowship years ago, there was this question at the end of every sermon, every Sunday morning. We would get to the end of it after looking at God's word, and we would pause. Somebody would come up here and say, hey, we're going to take the next minute or so and sit here, and we're going to ask this question. Yes, some of you have been here a long time. We're going to ask, so what? And y'all, we just made an opportunity, 60, 75 seconds to sit and go, God, what might you be saying to me in light of your truth from your word this morning? Is there an application? Is there something I need to do with a friend? Is there a way I need to move forward and encourage? Is there a place you're asking me to repent, to grow, to apply what I've heard? That's what I want to do today. I want to take a little extended so what, but with you. And think about this word deception. You know, the reality is, I think we learn about deception and lying at a pretty young age. You know, children are pretty young when they first learn these words. I'm telling mommy, or you're not telling the truth, or liar, liar, pants on fire. I mean, they're pretty young when they learn about deception that's not a good thing. And you know, it's actually a typical part of childhood development. You know, there's research that says if a child isn't lying by age 3, they're not developing in a healthy way. Okay, hang on. What? But it's true, you know, this is about power struggle. This is about development. Little children learn to lie because they're learning to go, can I get my way? Wonder who they learned that from, mom and dad, right? But they are. We learn at a very young age. You know, we're in the season of grandparenting, and it's so much fun. We've got these 7 little grandbabies running around all the time, and we'll be with them this afternoon. And, you know, the words I hear, you know, they're just flat out bold lies. You know, I watch my grandson slap, you know, his little brother upside the head and turns, I didn't hit him. You know, it's just like, really? You know, or that's my toy. And that toy's been sitting there all day, totally disinterested, but little sister gets it, and now I've got to have it. Or sissy did it, my little 3-year-old grandson. Those are the only 3 words I think he knows, you know. Sissy did it. He's constantly deceiving, bobbing and weaving. And y'all, can I tell you the truth? As a grandparent, deception is awesome. I mean, it's so fun watching them bob and weave and try to figure out how to get their way. Again, it's developmentally appropriate. It's what they're learning to do. Does it need to be taught? Does it need to be taught and addressed? Of course it does. But there's something about it that their little hearts, they're just trying so hard to go, mine, mine, mine. It's cute in little kids, right? But there's a lot of other things little kids do that when we become adults, most of us aren't trying to do those same things anymore. But there's something about deception. If we're not careful, we carry it into adulthood. I came across some research that was just from last year, 2023, on deception. It said this. Just quick bullet points. I thought they were just fun to read. An average person lies 1 to 2 times a day. Man, I read that and go, probably true. Secondly, 60% of people lie at least once in a 10-minute conversation. Think about that in the hallway today when you're talking to somebody after church, you know? Most of us, 60% of us. 40% of people lie on their resumes. I need to look better than I really am. 90% of people lie on their online dating profiles. Wow, watch out, single folks. Be careful. This one is so low. 50% of teenagers admit to lying to their parents about their whereabouts. Really? I think it's a higher number than that. 80% of women admit to lying to their partner about their spending habits. Yet, men lie twice as often as women, except golfers and fishermen, and they lie 10 times more, right? People are more likely to lie over the phone than face-to-face. That probably includes texting as well. Oh, no, we're busy. We can't come. And then my last one, perfect for this particular year we're in. Politicians lie on average once every 5 minutes during a debate. Get ready for a fun fall, right? You know, some of those statistics, they're no big surprise. We're like, yes, deception, as I said earlier, it's rampant in our culture. It's kind of become just the expectation. False news, created images on social media. We have all these different places where we're constantly discerning, is that true or is that not true? So easy to fall for it. And it comes in all shapes and sizes. You know, some deception just looks like a blatant lie. It's that moment when the officer walks right up and knocks on the window of your car. You roll the window down. He says, did you know you were going 80 in a 55? What do you say? I had no idea. You know, it's like blatant. We're just flat out lying. Sometimes it's misleading. My dad was masterful at this. In his early years of life, after he and mom got married, and when I was a little boy, dad would just constantly smoke. Every week he'd try to quit smoking. So he would hide cigarettes in the house, under the spare tire in his car. I mean, all sorts of places. And then he would just eat candy all the time, trying to, I guess, get it off his breath. But my mom was no fool. And mom would often say to him, Ray, have you been smoking today? To which he would respond, honey, that hurts me so bad that you would ask me that question. Right? I mean, today we'd call that gaslighting. But it was, I'm not going to give you a yes or a no. I'm going to see if I can redirect. Can I mislead you? Or half-truths. You know, you get that phone call. Hey, you going to be home soon? Oh, yeah. I'm leaving the office right now. Hey, heads up. When you say that, don't be clicking the keyboard. We can hear it on the other end, right? There's all these little ways that we learn to deceive. I just jotted down some few words. Broken promises. Secrets. Hiding, denial, avoidance, falsifying, concealing, omission, white lies, distortion, withholding. You know what we know about deception? Is ultimately, it never works. The key word there is ultimately. It can work really well in the short term. It can get you that job until it catches up with you. It's what we heard 2 weeks ago when we heard Paul's words scream out from Galatians 6. Don't be deceived. God isn't mocked. What a man sows, that he will reap. Sir Walter Scott was so right in the early 1800s. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Solomon in Proverbs 10, verse 9 said this, whoever walks in integrity walks securely. But he who makes his ways crooked will be found out. Like, we know that principle. Our deception always catches up with us. And yet in real time, we've got this little part of our brain that we push it to going, oh, it's okay. Nobody's going to find out. Y'all, the impact of deception is massive. I follow kind of what's going on in the church world at large. I have an opportunity to work with a lot of pastors and try to help them walk through different situations. And this past week, my heart's broken. Two more mega church pastors have fallen. Deception, hiding, stuff from the past coming out. What does that do to a congregation? Brokenness, loss of trust, relational damage. It's not just pastors. I'm not putting them on a pedestal like pastors shouldn't stumble. Of course they do. We all do. But the hiddenness that continues to happen, not just for them, but for any of us, it has a massive negative impact. You know, no show of hands this morning at all, but I wonder how many of us were raised in families or have a family story where deception really rocked us in some ways. Now, I think about exaggerations and broken promises. They don't seem that big of a deal, right? I mean, is that really deception, Jeff? Now, I remember a client of mine was talking about why is he deceiving with his wife so much and hating that he's doing it. Feels like he couldn't stop doing it. And one day we were processing some stuff, and out of nowhere, he said, can I tell you a story that I keep having a dream about that I keep remembering? I said, sure. He said, I'm 8 years old. My parents have divorced earlier in the spring, and it's summertime, and I'm out of school. And my dad, every Saturday, is coming to pick me up, so I have Saturdays with my dad. He goes, and I get dressed at 9 o'clock. I learn how to see exactly when it's 9 a.m. I go and I sit on the front porch. And I've got my baseball mitt in this hand. I got my glove right here, and I'm just popping. I'm waiting because Dad's coming to get me. Dad's coming to get me. I'm going to be hanging with Dad. You know where the story goes, right? Dad never shows. Dad never shows. That deception. What does that do to this 45-year-old man sitting in my office who remembers suddenly, wow, at 8 I started learning. Here's how you get away with things. You make a promise, but you don't have to keep it. So subtle, so powerful. Or the hidden behaviors that we learned about later in life. I so remember when I had the privilege of performing my grandmother's funeral, and a couple days beforehand, I gathered in the family room at her house with all of her children, 8, my dad and 7 siblings. And we just sat around and we were telling stories. And I'm taking notes and I'm asking questions. And then I don't know why, but I went logistical. I said, so what's grandma's birthday again? What year was she born? I jotted that down. And I said, and when were grandma and grandpa married? I never met my grandfather. He passed before I was born. And when I asked that question, when were they married, the room just went really, really weirdly silent. And I thought, huh, what have I stepped into? And I looked around, and one of my aunts said, well, Jack, you're the oldest. When were you born? Because mom and dad got married, I think, 10 months before then. I can do the math and figure out what they're saying. And so Jack tells me his birthday, and I go, oh, so they got married in October of 1917. They go, oh, yeah, that's it. I remember now. I said, hang on a minute. Y'all have always told a story about a stillborn baby long before Jack was born. Suddenly, the secret came out. My grandparents weren't as clean as they looked. It was a whole different story in my family of origin story. Then, of course, there's so many ways that these deceptions come out, but they have a negative impact on us. You know, today is Father's Day, and I so appreciate Mason giving a great shout out to you men. And so often it feels like in the church that Father's Day is a Sunday, go, hey, let's beat dads up, and they hope that they'll do a better job. Y'all, so not interested in that. I'm a father. I don't want to beat me up. I don't want to beat anybody up. I've had the privilege over the years of working with tons of dads. Dads who made awesome, wise choices. Dads who've walked really poorly and blown stuff up. Here's what I know at the depths of my soul. I think almost every man who becomes a father has a deep desire to leave a legacy of honor, of strength, of faithfulness, of integrity. I believe there's that deep desire in the heart of almost every man saying, I want to live that way. But to do that, dad's deception has to be eradicated from our lives. Unless you think this is only for dads, moms, people with no kids, kids, everybody, deception must be eradicated from our lives. Proverbs 12:19 is a great legacy verse. Truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for the moment. Truthful lips endure forever. That's legacy language, isn't it? Man, if my legacy when I die could just have the word integrity that my kids would speak about me, that I walked with fidelity and honesty, goodness gracious, wouldn't that be a compliment? But Solomon says, but a lying tongue, it only lasts for a moment. It shatters that. I don't think any mentally healthy person would say that deception is the best way to approach life or even a difficult situation. Yet, again, it's what we default to so quickly. Well, it leads me to one last question. Why then? Why do we end up deceiving when we know it's going to bite us every time? Back to the research just for a second. They had 4 reasons. It's why it seems like 4 primary reasons why it seems like we deceive. 1, self-preservation. I need to preserve my image. I need to preserve the way you think about me. I want to impress or boost my reputation. So in the spirit of self-preservation, let me deceive a little. Secondly, to protect someone else's feelings. This may be the one I hear the most. I can't come clean and talk about this because it would just crush her. It would just crush him. Therefore, I've got to keep the deception rolling. I've got to let the deception continue. Thirdly, to avoid conflict, embarrassment, consequences, or punishment. You know, one researcher said that avoiding punishment may be the main motivation for why we deceive, both children and adults. It's not just the kids. And then finally, to gain power over others or to get what I want. So sometimes I just deceive so I can get something that really isn't mine anyway. That's Jacob's story. It's a story of a lot of us. I was yesterday with a good friend of mine's son. He's 27 years old, sharp kid, got his first job, doing well. We were talking, and somehow we got off on the topic of, I'm embarrassed to say it, but of Lululemon pants. I surely don't own any, but He said it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to him. I thought, I got to get this kid out more. But he's telling me that evidently at Lululemon, if you're a college athlete, they give you a 30% discount. So he was telling me that several of his buddies that he worked with, you know, they're 24, 25, 26, they just go in and they tell that young 18-year-old girl, hey, I'm a baseball player at the University of Alabama. Cha-ching, 30%. Y'all, is your integrity really worth 30% on any price of anything? I don't think so, but if we want to get our way, that's the reason we end up deceiving sometimes. You think about Jacob's story. This is what he does to get more. Esau's birthright. Laban does the same thing. I'll deceive to get 7 more years out of Jacob. We deceive to find significance, security, power. The birthright opened up doors for Jacob to hide, to avoid trouble or consequences. There's a pattern Jacob's seeing of that. That's what his father did. That's what his grandfather did. Remember the story of Abraham when he's traveling and suddenly he realizes, ooh, it's expedient for me right now to say, oh, this is not my wife. She's my sister. Bald face lie, but this helps me get what I want. It helps me protect myself. So many reasons why we deceive, but I wonder foundationally, there's one word for all of us that sums up the reason why we deceive. And that word is this: fear. Fear. I wonder if underneath us, the reason we choose to bob and weave, deceive, lie, no matter how little, how big, is we're afraid. Self-preservation. Fear of being known, being rejected. Protecting someone else's feelings. Fear of hurting someone or being that person. Avoiding conflict, embarrassment, consequences. Fear of pain. Gain power over others to get what I want. Fear of not having enough. I think fear may be the most foundational reason that we spend time trying to figure out how do I get away with it in a way that's not honest. Maybe the worst deception of all, though, is self-deception. When I'm not deceiving you, I'm not lying to you, I'm honest with you, but on the inside, I've come to believe it's okay, it's no big deal. I mean, the phrase is, this job isn't that bad. I mean, I know what they're doing is kind of on the edge, but you know, it pays so good, and I think it'll be all right. Or maybe it's when someone says something to you or engages you in a difficult way, the lie you tell yourself, that didn't hurt that much, that's no big deal. They didn't mean it, they have a good heart. That's a great lie. My health, it's really okay. I don't think I need to go to the doctor. I think everything's really all right. Or, you know, I don't drink that much. I mean, I've got it under control. It's not that big of a deal. Or, you know, this behavior, it doesn't hurt anyone but me. So it's okay. It's probably not hurting me that much. We lie to ourselves. We deceive ourselves. See, fear causes deception to continue. And deception leads to isolation, shame and guilt, disconnection, and ultimately bondage. It's like we are in prison. The shackles, boom, they've come on us. Years ago, I had the privilege of taking a class with a gentleman named Dallas Willard. Some of you may know the name. If you don't, Dallas Willard was an interesting character. He was head of the philosophy department at the University of Southern California, and he was a Southern Baptist minister. Put those two things together, right? He was also an amazing Christian apologist, and he talked and wrote so much about spiritual formation. How do we become like Jesus? And in this class, there were about 20 of us in the class, intimate setting. On the last day, he asked this question of us, and it was such a simple question, I thought I immediately knew the answer. And he said this: was Jesus right about everything or just some things? And I thought, Sunday school question, man, I can get this one. Jesus is always right. And he said, let me explain it this way. John chapter 8, verse 32. Jesus speaking to the Jews, and he says, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The context, Jesus is talking about salvation. This is how you've lived, thinking that you're going to find freedom, that you're going to live by obeying the law. Jesus is coming along saying, hey, there's a whole new order. There's a whole new way coming. And if you want to be set free, you have to know the truth. So in John 8, 32, this passage is about salvation. The truth of salvation in Christ alone. And then Willard said this: but when Jesus speaks words from his mouth, are they universally true? In other words, when he says, you will know the truth about anything, the truth then will set you free. And y'all, there was an awkward pause in that classroom. I think as we began sitting and thinking about what does that mean, that freedom is only found in truth speaking. You know, it's interesting. If you really play with that concept, when I choose to hold on to my deception, and y'all hear me, I say that compassionately. I think it's so easy. And the longer I've had a lie, the longer I've been deceiving, the harder it is to take my hands off it. But when I choose to hold on to my little secret, the longer I do that, the more I hold on to it. In effect, what I'm saying is, Jesus, you're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about, and you are a liar. And let me tell you why, Jesus, because my deception is doing what to me? If we were honest in our deception, we would have to say, I don't believe you, Jesus. I don't believe you that truth sets me free. So I'll just hold on to my little secret. In the recovery world, the 12-step world, a great phrase, you're only as sick as your secrets. I think that's the principle right here. Truth is what liberates. You know, as I've sat in my office with people through the years, I have never met someone who came out of the bondage of deception and decided to tell the truth, who came back to me later and said, man, I really regret telling the truth. Never once heard it. And you need to understand, there's some massive consequences sometimes. I think of one friend who told the truth and he was barred and disqualified from his position, could never serve in that industry again the rest of his life. But he would say, but I'm free now. I found another way to provide for my family. I'm free now. I think of the people who tell the truth and unfortunately the marriage becomes irreparable and it can't be repaired and it leads to a divorce. And that's tragic and that's sad. And that's not what you hope for. And yet there's a part of freedom that comes from truth speaking. Never heard anyone say, man, I wish I'd have kept the lie going. The deception would have been a better course for my life. You know, the simple truth is that the very first deception that ever happened in the Garden of Eden, that serpent, right? The deceiver. The serpent comes to Eve and deceives her, Adam right there with her. And the simple truth is nothing has really changed. Deception continues to come at us and continues to destroy. You know, I guess if we were to kind of bring our so what down to a close this morning, I would just say this. So what? In our lives, the only biblical response to deception is put it to death. Crucify it. Make it gone. Eradicate it. Dads, one more time, just to you and me. I feel like our world is so hungry and desperate for godly, healthy, truth-speaking men. We have plenty of boys in this culture, but there's such a need for men who will rise up, who will be models to their families and to the world around them, who will live with integrity, honor, strength, faithfulness. What I believe men long for, but the barrier becomes, oh, but I can't because I need to hide. The gospel compels us that I do not have to hide any longer. See, the death of deception leads to the resurrection of freedom. And this morning, maybe for some of us, as we prepare to come to the Lord's table in just a few minutes, maybe we need to pause and just say, Lord, is there work you want to do in me? I want to give you a couple questions to consider as we sit here in silence for just about a minute. Is there a place that the Spirit is inviting you to come out of deception and speak truth? Like Jacob, do you need to hear God's voice inviting you to return home? Maybe some of us need to wrestle with that question I had to wrestle with Dallas Willard. Is Jesus always right? Does truth really set us free? Would you take just 60 seconds and sit in silence and invite the Spirit to gently nudge to speak to you?